This is episode 435. Do you know someone with dementia or Alzheimer's disease? Currently, the USA has almost 7 million Alzheimer's sufferers, and there are 500,000 in Australia and millions in other countries that live with this dreadful disease. And those numbers are only going up. And by 2050, it's an industry predicted to be worth over $1 trillion annually. But what if we're heading in the wrong direction with it, medically speaking? Because as it turns out, Alzheimer's disease research took a nasty turn a long time ago. Here, we're diving in with an investigative journalist that is actively exposing the huge levels of corruption that researchers and profit-driven pharma executives have been trying to hide, which likely derailed the medical industry off the path of curing Alzheimer's disease more than two decades ago. There's some saucy stuff in here that needs to be heard. If you've ever watched or read Empire of Pain, Dope Sick, The Magic Pill, American Addict, or any of those corruption, truth-seeking medical pharma industry docos, then you're going to enjoy this conversation. So without further ado, let's get into it.
Welcome to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. You've tuned in because you want to start taking your health seriously so you don't, well, get sick and die. Here we talk all things health, nutrition, and human optimization. Let's jump into it with your host and resident scientist, Maddie Lansdowne.
What's up, my healthy friends? Welcome to this podcast episode here today. And to start, so you don't forget, which is very pertinent for today's topic, it's my mission to coach 500 people to achieve real weight loss. And by real, I mean more than just cutting away your body fat. And we do it without calorie counting, without embarrassing weigh-ins or a forbidden food list. If you feel that it's time to prioritize you and your health for a change, then the link to book a call and inquire with us about what we do is down in the show notes below and the caption as well. Okay, so to today's guest here, I'd like you to meet Charles Piller, who is an author and an investigative journalist for Science Magazine, and his work has appeared in countless publications all over the world, and he's produced amazing pieces of writing and authored books that you might have read before. Titles like Gene Wars, The Fail-Safe Society, and the big one for today's chat, Doctored: Fraud, Arrogance, and Tragedy in the Quest for a Cure to Alzheimer's. He's received many journalism awards, and we're here today to talk specifically about what on earth is going on in Alzheimer's disease research. So Charles, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Maddie. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, I'm rapt to have you here. I've been listening to your podcasts all week and your bits and pieces that you've done, and it sounds like you have jumped down some big rabbit holes that are making a lot of people frustrated, to say the least. But I guess let's go back to the beginning. What happened two decades ago that caused Alzheimer's disease research to go in the wrong direction?
Yeah, it's a very frustrating story, really. So just to take it one step before that, for about three decades, the Alzheimer's disease research community has been dominated by a particular way of thinking about the disease called a hypothesis. The amyloid hypothesis is the title given to it. And this is an idea that these particular kind of proteins called amyloid proteins begin a cascade of biochemical reactions in the brain that lead to dementia. And so this has been the idea that has dominated research spending. It's dominated drug development, and it's dominated, you could say, mind share, not just among scientists and regulators, but also in patient advocates and people who are pushing really hard to help patients try to find an approach to dealing with this terribly tragic ailment, Alzheimer's disease. So for the period between the kind of establishment of this hypothesis in the 80s and the middle 90s and up through the 2000s, what we were seeing is a lot of drug development and even vaccine development associated with this amyloid hypothesis that resulted in failure after failure after failure of these drugs to provide any relief from the cognitive decline of Alzheimer's. And so there was mounting frustration associated with this hypothesis. So in 2006, something really profound happened in the field. It was an experiment by scientists at the University of Minnesota in the United States. And this experiment found what was described as the first specific amyloid protein to cause dementia in animal studies. And so what they concluded was from this pretty interesting experiment that involved extracting a very, very specific protein from the brains of mice, purifying it in the lab, injecting it into rats, and causing what were memory problems that were akin to Alzheimer's in people. And so this experiment was heralded as an important step forward for the field. It was, over the period of time from then until a couple of years ago, was the fourth most cited experimental study in the field in that entire time period. So
yeah, wow.
It was not just heralded, but it signified to the field that we have reason to believe that we're on the right track with the amyloid hypothesis. And it had targeted a specific subtype of these amyloid proteins called oligomers, getting into the weeds a little bit scientifically. But the point was that it was a big step forward. So now, to sort of bring us back closer to the present, about 3 years ago, I began a series of discussions with a scientist at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, in the U.S., the name of Matthew Schrag, who kind of in his spare time, not on the company dime, you might say, was working on understanding better some image integrity issues in science. So this is looking at things like microscopic pictures of brain tissue or analysis. There's a kind of analysis photograph that is used often to identify proteins in these scientific experiments that involve neuroscience and Alzheimer's disease. And he found that there was reason to believe that the experiments that were at the heart of this study that was so earth-shaking and really set the amyloid hypothesis back on a path of dominance in the field were actually faked, that these images were doctored using software like Photoshop that many of your listeners might be familiar with.
Yeah, that's really shocking, especially since we're so far down the belief of that idea as a fundamental pillar of how Alzheimer's disease functions. And so my guess is that we have put billions of dollars in pharmaceutical funding into developing drugs based on that idea. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right, Mandy. In fact, it's billions of dollars by the pharmaceutical companies for drug development and for testing, and also billions of dollars by the U.S. federal government for their Alzheimer's research programs, and also enormous sums of money by other governments around the world who have been studying this idea. Now, just to be clear, it wasn't just this one experiment that set the stage for all of that spending. There were other experiments. There's other deeply embedded beliefs in the field that pushed people in that direction. But this experiment was a kind of validation, a kind of a reality check that seemed to make people feel that they were really on the right track. And of course, we know now that they were not. So what, just to close the loop on that part of the story, Matthew Schrag and I spoke many, many times about this and ultimately resulted in a story that I wrote in Science Magazine in 2022 that, in a sense, was the genesis of my book, Doctored. It was the first case example that I've looked at very, very closely that showed that fundamental thinking in the field had been steered by apparently bogus research, apparent misconduct in the field. And that was just the beginning.
There's so many ways I want to take this conversation because there's all these things going off in my head. But the thing you said before, I'm curious about, because you said that there was already beliefs in the Alzheimer's disease research community that this paper was built on that were also maybe not totally logical or viable or had been proven. I'm curious to know what some of those beliefs or ideas were that were also a part of this narrative that evolved on what appeared to be stable ground, but that was actually not where we were meant to head.
Sure. I think there's a few things that are pretty troubling about how the amyloid hypothesis became dominant. But I want to say, first of all, that it's not a completely ridiculous idea. I think even the harshest critics of the amyloid hypothesis would say that amyloid proteins have something to do with Alzheimer's. And there's reason to believe that both from very narrow genetically predisposed populations who have genes that produce a lot of amyloid in their brains and get early onset Alzheimer's. And there's some connection there. Additionally, by definition, by the definition that was made by the discoverer of the disease, that's Alzheimer in 06, by definition, the disease is a combination of the presence of these sticky plaques called amyloid beta protein plaques, and also these other kind of protein tangle inside the nerve cells called tau proteins. So what Alzheimer did is he looked at these two characteristics in a particular patient who was exhibiting the signs of dementia, of forgetfulness and loss of identity, and just all of the terrible symptoms associated with Alzheimer's disease. And he essentially decided that the presence of these two proteins along with dementia symptoms equals Alzheimer's disease. And so this was a very well accepted idea for 100 years, but the amyloid cascade hypothesis, where it causes this series of biochemical changes in the brain, that was not developed until many decades later. And it was not developed until scientists came to the conclusion that it caused this range of changes. So what, in a sense, went wrong with thinking in the field? Well, there have always been some contradictions in the amyloid hypothesis. Just to give you one example, even though by definition the disease afflicts people who have amyloid proteins in their brain, and you know this nowadays from some brain scans, you can determine that, but also it used to be only on autopsy. After people had died and their brains were autopsied, you could see the presence of these proteins in their brain. And so what has also been learned by scientists is that people with no cognitive symptoms, in other words, just thinking as normally as any regular person, even into old age, and then die and had their brains autopsied, were found to have loads of amyloid protein in their brain. So it just because you have the amyloid proteins in your brain, it doesn't define you as being inevitably going to get Alzheimer's disease. So this was one of the several contradictions in the field, including the fact that the removal of these proteins using particular drugs or even vaccine-oriented approaches to removing the proteins, they failed over and over. In other words, people didn't get better. Now, before I go further into how this became entrenched, I just want to mention that listeners may be aware that recently in the United States, a couple of new drugs have been approved for the use in Alzheimer's disease that are called anti-amyloid antibodies. So these are drugs that are essentially operating a little like a passive immune system. In the immune system, people's bodies learn how to produce antibodies that attack invaders into your body. So bacteria or viruses, when you have an illness, your immune system kicks in and tries to destroy those viruses or bacteria so that you can obtain better health and get over the disease. In Alzheimer's, it's a similar thing. They create these antibodies in the lab that are, they call it passive immune response. So it's not that your body's producing them naturally, it's that they're being injected into you, and then they serve the role of immune cells. So you have to have repeated injections. They don't become part of your immune system. And these anti-amyloid antibodies have been developed and approved by the federal government. Now, you might be asking, well, doesn't that suggest that they work and that they're a cure for Alzheimer's? And unfortunately, the benefits and the risks of these drugs are very, very far distant from making them a cure. So first of all, they do not improve the condition of the patient. So you can take it and you do not get better. Your cognition does not improve as a result of taking these. Second, it doesn't arrest Alzheimer's symptoms. So in other words, you don't stay at the state you are. In other words, not get worse, not have your cognition get worse and worse over time. Instead, they slow the rate of cognitive decline to a minute degree. And the degree of slowing of decline is so small as to be imperceptible to many clinicians and patients. So in other words, there is some statistical benefit that may not be clinically observable in many cases. And additionally, they carry very, very significant dangers, including brain swelling and bleeding that can cause death. So they have the most stringent health warning on the product label required by the Food and Drug Administration in the United States, which is the so-called black box warning of possible death from taking the drug. So I just want to say that even though these drugs have been approved by the Food and Drug Administration, it doesn't mean that they're a cure or a solution for Alzheimer's disease. And that's where we stand. We still stand in a situation where the amyloid hypothesis remains quite dominant in the field, and yet has still not produced anything that's anything remotely close to a cure or even something that can suspend the decline of patients.
It's wild to me that we can have drugs that are being prescribed to people that give an imperceptible, like, positive benefit, but on the other side have a possibility of death. That feels like a seesaw that nobody would consciously get on.
Yeah, it's troubling. It's troubling for a couple of reasons. There are a lot of unknowns associated with these drugs as well. Let me give you one example. For the anti-amyloid antibodies, one thing we know that they do is that they shrink the brain. They shrink brain to a much greater degree than the brain shrinks with Alzheimer's disease itself. And so you have to ask yourself the question, what are the long-term effects of these drugs if they are known to shrink the brain? So one of the perplexing elements of this question is that the company that developed the first of these drugs, something called Leqembi, that's the brand name, in their protocol for their experiment associated with this, they did not agree to share data like that with the public or with other scientists. Consequently, we're not going to learn the full story of the degree of brain shrinkage over time for people that continue to take the drug. And to me, that's also troubling because I think open science is the kind of science that can be validated and checked by independent authorities.
Yeah, absolutely. And the more that you build this picture out, the more that I guess my suspicion rises, because you've just talked about how we've now got a drug on the market that has a tiny, minuscule benefit that doesn't really change much for the patient themselves with a risk of death. And then we've got a company that's making the drug that doesn't want to show you the data. And then that takes us back to the conversation around the doctored and photoshopped image, which a lot of these concepts were partially built upon. It feels like every step of the way, there's somebody that's not doing their job correctly. And what I mean by not correctly is the public's perception of what those jobs should be doing correctly, if you know what I mean.
Yes, I do. And I might add, Maddie, that I know that you have a scientific background and you are someone who does believe in the importance of doing well-constructed, thoughtful scientific studies. This is how we move knowledge forward. And I also share that view. And I must say that it's discouraging for me to have to say in my book, Doctored, that we have a situation where there's been a lot of falsification of research, a lot of misconduct in the field, and a lot of apparent image doctoring. And why that's discouraging is that there are a lot of really determined, thoughtful, and I think honest scientists in the field who are struggling to find the best pursuit of how to cure this disease. And what's so frustrating about it is when ideas that have been based on false information or on scientific misconduct can get traction in the field, it can slow down the pursuit of legitimate ideas associated with the disease and slow down other scientists' ability to get funding to get those ideas out into the mainstream and to be able to do drug development associated with them. So it's, let me put it this way, in every walk of life, there are people who are dishonest. In every walk of life, there is misconduct of some kind. And I don't think Alzheimer's scientists or scientists as a whole are any more dishonest. There is any higher percentage of people who are doing improper activities in that field than any other human endeavor. That said, it's particularly hard in Alzheimer's for a couple of reasons. One is that unlike many of the most important disease categories, there's been, for example, a lot of help in combating things like heart disease, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease of various kinds, stroke. And one of the reasons that's been able to happen is good research has been done. Good remedies have been found in certain cases to save or extend lives. Alzheimer's has been different. There has been no really good effective remedy developed for Alzheimer's in the entire period of time that it's been studied. And it's become more and more prevalent because we have an aging population, and it's primarily a disease of aging. And so it's a very discouraging situation. So it's a situation like this is that when you have a substantial amount of improper activity, such as image doctoring in a field like this, is that it can have a bigger, more deleterious effect than you can have in other fields. It's because you're not getting traction. And as a result, we have this very discouraging situation we see with Alzheimer's, which is a lot of frustration, a lot of lack of progress, the anguish that family members feel who are taking care of loved ones who are experiencing this terrible disease. And it's a gigantic societal problem that I think is in part due to the improprieties that I've found in many examples in my book.
Yeah, and I just want to echo what you shared before about the sort of honesty and dishonesty of people. And I share that belief that, you know, I've worked in hospitals, I've worked with doctors, I've worked with pharmaceutical reps, I've worked with lots of people in the industry of which I now have great suspicion for, but I don't believe they're any more honest or dishonest than myself. And every human, you know, wants to further their career and wants to provide for their family. And I feel like the way I think about it, especially, and this Alzheimer's disease research history is a prime example, is that if we're going from Earth to the moon and we're on that trajectory, and every person in this system makes a 1% adjustment, like just a 1 degree change in the degree of truth in their information or the words that they choose or the pushing of something or the accepting of something that's slightly just 1 degree out of the norm. If you've got 5 people in that, you're all of a sudden 5 degrees, you know, off course. And that, by the time you get to the moon, you've missed the moon. But then add in the hundreds of people that are a part of these processes and journals, and then the people that cite that work that all move 1 degree slightly out. You know, we're so far off course, you know, that it's unimaginable that we were even heading to the moon to begin with. And so I think it's just these slight deviations in each human. And then, I mean, you could definitely argue in many cases that there's some body at the top that's, you know, financially incentivized that doesn't care about health at all. And that's a rabbit hole for another day, probably. But the point is that, yeah, I think it's just slowly, 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 all the contributors just move 1 degree in the wrong direction. And then we end up miles away from where we started.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty apt way of describing it, Maddie. I think that can happen. I can describe a little bit of the apparent way in which it takes place, where this falsification comes from and goes to. Before I do, I just wanted to make one last point about what we're talking about. I certainly agree with how you characterize the kind of degree of dishonesty or honesty that human beings have. I mean, all of us are flawed and make mistakes. I would hesitate, of course, to generalize too much. So, for example, my articles about this topic have been covered at times by people who have really terribly misrepresented the meaning of them in this way. They say things like, well, if one important study in Alzheimer's was falsified, then all Alzheimer's research is unreliable and none of it is believable. And this is, of course, ridiculous. There's a lot of good science out there. And what we want to do is support good science and expose science that is not well constructed or may be the product of misconduct. It's vital to do that. Listeners might be asking themselves, well, how does this even happen? How does a scientist go down this path of falsification? And as you can imagine, I've thought about this for hours and hours and hours because it's so central to the psychology of this whole question. And for me, I can easily imagine it going sort of in this way. There is a kind of way in which you can change images in science that is considered to be quote unquote beautification, to make the images look a little bit sharper or clearer, but not change them in a way that is misrepresenting the results of the experiment. And even though this is regarded widely as being improper, it's been so much overlooked or even accepted within the scientific community that it gives people kind of a sense of complacency when the next step might be taken. And that might be, I'm a scientist so deeply convinced of my own ideas, and not just the certainty of them, but their importance, that I feel I didn't quite get the result I was looking for in my experiment, but maybe I can just make this slight alteration that points it in the direction that I know it was already going in. And that kind of change in an image, that's really bordering on misconduct. And then the next step might be, well, no one noticed that I made those changes, and I know that I'm right. I know that this is important. Even though I didn't get anything close to the experimental result I was looking for, I'm just going to go ahead and copy and paste and change the image in such a way that it represents my ideas more effectively. That is frank misconduct. And this is what I found over and over and over in doctored examples from dozens of important scientists within the Alzheimer's community, just very, very discouraging. Which is, again, not to say that no other field of science has problems with misconduct or no other field of human endeavor does, but in Alzheimer's, the impact can be even greater.
Do you want to know how to lose weight without counting calories or needing to use restrictive diets? Turns out the answer is on Instagram. You might be interested to know that over 70% of our paying clients begin their journey with a weight loss goal. Most of them achieve this goal without fad diets and without calorie counting. And in the process, they also rewire their brains to stop craving sugar, and they stop their secret binge eating sessions without the need to use loads of willpower. Why does what we do work? Because the fat that you want to lose, it isn't just about the calories you're consuming. It's actually wild how differently we do things. We work on your mind, and your body gets better. And I think more people need to know about how we can do this for you too. Which is exactly why I'm back on Instagram as The Real Weight Loss Coach. If you want to know how to really drop the weight that's been holding you down, how to keep it off, and to stay healthy long into the future, then follow me on Instagram. The link to my profile is in the show notes below, or you can search for me on Instagram by typing in The Real Weight Loss Coach. Give me a follow and I'll chat to you in the comments and the DMs over there.
Yeah, and I would just like to say as well that I have been sitting at my desk chair listening to conversations between colleagues and professors and mentors where those conversations were normal. And I was at an age where I didn't know if that was how you did things or, you know, for instance, a result would come back negative and there'd just be a conversation about how can we use this data and write a different narrative around it? Or how can we use this data to change it to the other way around or to shift different things and say, oh, there is a result. It's just, you know, in this direction. And so, and I just thought for a long time that was normal. And especially when you're surrounded by people doing honors degrees and PhDs and postdocs that are trying to, you know, it's a huge amount of work. And so you want to pass because you don't want to have to do 4 years of study and research and 4 a.m. lab visits again. And so when your professor is offering alternatives to your negative data to make it positive in some way, of course that's appealing, you know? It's like, oh my God, I've done so much work to get here. And there's also that negativity bias, or rather the positivity bias and avoiding of negative publishing negative data because, you know, it feels like you've wasted your time or it doesn't move the field forward or journals don't really accept much negative data. But I've been in the presence of exactly what you're describing many times.
I think you're absolutely right, Maddie. That's a really good example of how it often comes down. Even can be more direct and crass than that. So, for example, one of the examples I look at in doctored is a guy by the name of Berislav Zlakovich, who was a professor at the University of Southern California. He's now on indefinite leave because of some of the work that I've written about.
Wow.
Some of the writings that I've done. And he was an illustrious person in Alzheimer's disease and stroke. And what I learned, pursuant to what you were saying about your own experience, is that he pressured his students and his junior scientists to essentially only come up with the right data. The right data, meaning data that would supplement and validate his experimental thinking. And Consequently, because he was so powerful and their jobs depended on their ability to satisfy his demands, you ended up going, as you say, down this rabbit hole of deceit and dishonesty that was so painful for some of these young scientists with whom I spoke. Some of them, it kind of ruined their careers and destroyed their faith in science as a whole. Now, I want to mention, if I may, one other example.
Yeah.
When people think of the scale of this problem in Alzheimer's, and again, I don't want to cast aspersions on all Alzheimer's scientists, many of whom I deeply respect, but there is an example that is described in some detail in the book that I think is of great interest to the scientific community. And that is a guy by the name of Eliza Mosley, who, when I started writing about him, which was my story in Science Magazine, which is described in detail in the book and expanded on, when I started writing about him last year, he was the director of the Division of Neuroscience of the National Institutes of Health, which is the U.S. federal agency that is the biggest funder of Alzheimer's research in the world, and is the agency that establishes patterns and trends and that provides leadership and guidance to the entire field. So what I found through the cooperation of a number of expert forensic image analysts, some of them call themselves image sleuths, and they were able to help me do a methodical analysis of Mosley's work over a period of more than 25 years. And what was found was that in more than 130 studies that he was involved in, and this is a guy who was one of the most influential scientists in his field for decades, but over 130 of his studies involving Alzheimer's and Parkinson's research, including studies that have led to the development of and sale of drugs that they were based on falsified or incorrect, deeply flawed images, many of them with very clear signs of image doctoring. Now, the day my story on this appeared in Science last fall, he was no longer the head of his division at NIH. I don't know where he stands now, but obviously it changed everything for him, and as it should. But what's so profound about the story to me is that this is a guy at the pinnacle of the power structure, the money structure, and the influence structure of this disease, who was found to have been falsifying and incorrectly displaying images for literally for decades and steering the field in wrong-headed directions.
It makes you wonder how people like that get to those positions. But at the same time, you know, it doesn't take much thinking to realize that, you know, you use the word he's the most influential. And so in order to dominate and climb and succeed, you often need to be influential. It's just in this case that was used in an unfavorable way. And I actually, what's coming up in my head at the moment is just feeling sorry for all of the students that learned from him, or that would have picked up, you know, ideas about what's okay and what's not okay. And, you know, and then it disseminates through the system of all of these people that think that they're doing the right thing. They're pleasing their kind of aggressive, grumpy professor. But in practice, they have absorbed some of these practices. And so then you've got, yeah, these problems showing up all over the place.
I think you're right about that, Maddie. And I think that's one of the slippery slope aspects to the prevalence of misconduct. I think we should also be clear, though, that the reason why there is widespread misconduct in science, and in particularly in Alzheimer's disease, is for the fact that the institutional authorities of science have been complacent, and they have been ignoring or simply naive about how to examine these papers, not just for their possible scientific value, but also for their possible doctoring or fraud. And so when I talk about institutional authorities, I mean, one, the journals that publish these papers. Until recently, most journals didn't pay close attention to the possibility of image doctoring. Now, more and more, they're beginning to, because of all the bad publicity that in the last few years that has come out about various scientists who have doctored images. But there's still a long way to go before they're really on top of that. So it's one, it's the journals. to the universities. So when an accusation of possible misconduct is made in the United States, it is almost inevitably given back to the university to investigate the scientists at their institution who were allegedly involved in misconduct. And the problem with that is that universities are very risk averse, and they have the most to lose and the least to gain by conducting an independent-minded, rigorous, and prompt investigation of something that could be steering the field in wrong directions. So what you have often is investigations that go on for months or even years. And then when the results are finally known, they're often not made public. So it's a terrible way of investigating possible misconduct. And third, the governmental organizations that provide most of the grant funding for these folks, they've also been complacent. Just to give you an idea of how severe that is, in the case of Eliezer Maslia, the former head of the National Institute on Aging, Division of Neuroscience. So when I did the story for Science, I approached the NIA, of course, and asked them, did this person, was he vetted for his accuracy and for possible image doctoring when he became the head of this division? This was back in 2016, when the problem of image doctoring was actually quite well known and was beginning to be understood to be pretty widespread in the field. And their answer was, not only did they not do it, but they didn't see any value in doing it, and that they didn't see any value in doing it in the future. And utterly shocking level of complacency in the face of this terrible evidence about one of their top leaders.
I remember when I was working under a professor and a postdoc in the cancer hospital years ago now, but they sent me along to a seminar, and I forget who it was by, but it was put on by this American professor, and he had been doing running the reproducibility committee, which was based in the USA at the time. And he'd done 52 of the biggest, most cited, most peer-reviewed studies at the time, or in the last sort of 5 years before that. And the whole point of the reproducibility study was making sure that these landmark studies could be reproduced, the results could be reproduced. And they found, and I might get this number wrong because it's years ago that I went to the seminar, but it was about 48. It was a very large percentage of the studies could not be reproduced in third-party independent labs. And the point of him sort of going on this scientific tour around the world was just illustrating that many of these studies that are done are very, very difficult to reproduce, and therefore, why are they reliable? Why are they highly cited? But the point that I wanted to get to was that a lot of these studies, because of the way the hierarchical system of producing science and credible science works, and you know, it's very much, I think, of the term, it's who you know, not what you know, and people with their connections and affiliated with the right organizations, is that when they started bringing out this information about these studies not being able to be reproduced, and then therefore questioning why drugs were made off the back of those studies, was that huge legal claims, multi seven-figure, multi eight-figure legal claims came at this reproducibility committee, and they had to shut it down because there was just, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of being sued for trying to essentially debunk or prove that the science wasn't that rigid. And so I guess I think of that because, and I reference it a lot because it takes me back to this place of thinking there's a hierarchy and a system and a power struggle in all of these organizations that may exist. Not all scientists, like we said, or doctors or researchers are bad, but we all have to be complicit to the person that's paying our salary. And those people have a lot of money to be able to bully and push people out of the space, you know, that are bringing truth and honesty, or are willing to admit, hey, this study didn't work, or hey, this is some negative data, we need to try again, because then you need to ask for money again to do the next study.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Maddie. And I think part of the problem is that the incentive structure for success in academia is really flawed. And the publisher perish idea can skew people into publishing things that are not accurate, or publishing trivialities in order to try to advance in their career somehow. And as you mentioned, no one ever really advanced much in their career by taking on the veracity of scientists in the field, particularly powerful people in the field. This is one of the reasons why I find Matthew Schrag at Vanderbilt University to be quite courageous. He's a junior guy. He actually just got tenure, but during the whole period in which he was working on this, he didn't have tenure at his university, and he was only getting his own lab fully established with his own grants. But he was courageous enough to take on the top journals, the top scientists in his field, and to be a truth teller in a way that's very difficult to do, very difficult to do even for a more senior person. So that is a key factor to it. The incentive structures really need to be changed. There needs to be a better emphasis on training scientists to understand that integrity is not just a part of the process, but it's central to the process of creating science.
So I'm curious to know, with your book coming out and all the work you've done behind the scenes, collecting the data and asking the hard questions and pressuring organizations and establishments and people, do you feel that this has had an influence on Alzheimer's disease research that's going to push it in the right direction?
Well, there's only one point for me to be in this business, and it's to move the needle on that. And I do feel cautiously optimistic that this book will have a big effect. The reason I am able to say that is that I have now been writing about this for more than 2 years at Science Magazine, and I know that my articles, which have exposed these important examples of misconduct, have had an effect on the field because I've been informed by the numerous important scientists that they've read and absorbed the messages of this and have taken on creative thinking about how to take the next steps. Now, it's not all me, obviously. There's an enormous number of others who are trying to focus on these set of problems, including this kind of cottage industry of what again, they call themselves image sleuths, who are people that are not even necessarily trained as scientists, but who have the expertise to examine technical images and to try to find either flaws or misconduct associated with those images. And that is something that's new because of the tools of the internet age. And it's, in my opinion, it's embarrassing the heck out of the scientific institutions because these people are so often correct. They're finding things that should have been found by the institutional authorities and putting them to shame. And so this is an important development that I think is impossible to hide from now because it's so prevalent and there's so many people out there looking for it. So I guess I would just say this is a field that needs to do some broader thinking, that needs to take a good hard look in the mirror at whether its past practices were well serving the community of patients and clinicians that it's trying to serve. And my belief is that there's hope that there will be change in the field. There will be broader thinking about possible ways to approach Alzheimer's disease. Even though it's been a very, very discouraging run with no really good, solid evidence of cures or remedies that even arrest the decline of cognitive abilities in Alzheimer's patients, I think those days are going to come and that there's reason for people who are either just fearful of the disease or who are experiencing it with a loved one, there's still reason to hope that things, better times may be coming.
Yeah, well, that's good. And I think as well, you know, there's the pros and cons to the AI movement and all of these changes with technology, because as much as we can identify falsification, we can probably cover it up even more effectively as well, which is sort of scary. And the small, you know, 6 or 7 year period that I spent as a cancer research lackey tells me that AI, or rather image sleuths, are going to have their work cut out for them because there's a lot of data to trawl through. But I guess the thing that I wanted to ask you, Charles, like yourself, and maybe less about your work, was, you know, the way that I think of investigative journalists in many ways is kind of like Batman in a way. From the outside, it kind of looks like, you know, a byproduct of investigative journalism in this field particularly is policing the scientists and the doctors and the medical and pharma industry, and at least trying to expose them in an attempt to force some level of accountability or change, just as we were talking about. And so I think, you know, if people like yourself is playing a vigilante role in this science community, because I'm guessing that someone that is poking and prodding and prying into things that people are intentionally hiding can come with some risks, some really dangerous ones. And depending how far down the rabbit hole you go, there have been journalists that have been permanently erased from memory, you know, for what they've been looking into in the medical world and the pharmaceutical world. And I assume that comes with possibly a lot of legal problems too. So I'm curious, you know, all of that to preface the question, what motivates someone like yourself to get into this line of journalism?
Well, thank you, first of all, for the support you're expressing, Maddie. I appreciate that. Yes, I mean, there are risks associated with doing this kind of work. And of course, I've been threatened many times, not just in social media, but legally threatened. And those threats have basically come to nothing, I'm glad to say, even though anybody can sue over anything in this country anyway. The reason they've come to nothing is that the threats have been empty. That part of the way in which you can do this work effectively is to be right. And to be right, you have to be extremely careful and extremely dogged in not just seeking out factual information and accurate representations of that information from outside experts, but to also double, triple, quadruple check everything that you say and do in a book like Doctored in order to be able to be above reproach. Even a small error or two, which may seem trivial in the common order of things, can cast aspersions on the overall body of work that a person does. And so I'm extremely very, very careful to be accurate and fair-minded about it. And I want to say two things about the approach that I think the best investigative journalists use and that I aspire to. One is, when I say fair-minded, I mean that every person in this book and in all of my articles for whom the possibility of misconduct is raised and the accusations or the concerns about it are raised or the possibility of image doctoring and scientific images is raised, they are given not just an opportunity to respond to questions about it, but I make sure they know exactly what's going to be in my book or my story before anything goes to press. So, for example, it means sending them all of the examples of possible misconduct, asking them questions that describe in great detail what I'm after in such a way that there's no ambiguity about what's going to be in the story or the book. And the reason I do that is that I am deeply committed to giving these people an opportunity to state their case. And in my experience, nearly all the time when someone has a decent story to tell and is willing to tell it, they look better. They have an argument to make that makes them a more sympathetic character in the book. But when they refuse to talk, when they refuse to even have a conversation or to do anything but deny, then it doesn't distinguish them well. And what I've found is that as long as I'm careful, as long as I'm hewing closely to the facts and not getting myself out on a ridiculous limb of making claims or accusations that I can't verify, and as long as I'm fair-minded and deliberate in my approach to give everyone an opportunity to state their case, that I can generally bypass the worst kinds of problems that people run into when they behave in the cavalier way that I'm accusing others of behaving in. And that's my watchword of it. That said, I have had threats and I've managed them because, like I say, they didn't have anything.
Yeah, well, I think that kind of integrity is what's needed. And the best way to lead is by doing rather than saying. So I think what you're doing is incredible. And I think, yeah, the work that you're putting out there is incredible as well. And I guess for everybody listening that's resonating or, you know, knows people that have Alzheimer's or know people that work in Alzheimer's research, maybe, where can everybody find your book online and where would you like to send people?
Well, so for listeners in the US and Canada, my publisher is Simon & Schuster, and you can easily find me with a web search of my name, Charles Piller and Simon & Schuster, and you'll find the web page on their website that describes how to order the book. And of course, you can get it from any local bookstore or any of the online retailers as well. In the US and Canada, I'm sorry, in the United Kingdom and the Commonwealth countries, including Australia, you can get the book via my UK publisher. That's Icon, I-C-O-N. And again, all of the buying opportunities and options are available on their webpage or by any major reseller in the UK or in Australia. So it should be pretty easily available.
Fantastic. I will put some links down in the show notes in the caption below so that anybody can go and get their hands on it, which I would definitely recommend because I think, yeah, sharing this kind of truth allows us all to be a part of the solution of putting our doctors under a little more pressure and putting the people that are prescribing under a bit more pressure by being able to ask questions and look into this information. So I'll put those links down below. And for us to round out this conversation of all of the things that you've learned over your investigative journalism career in the world of health, what do you believe is one piece of health information that you wish more people knew about?
Well, I'd like to leave people with a thought about Alzheimer's disease itself. And that is, it's a mysterious disease, and it's a terrible and terrifying disease. But that said, there's something that each of us can do to both have a degree of protective effect and to perhaps forestall, if we're slated to get Alzheimer's disease for reasons that aren't fully understood, either genetic or due to other reasons. There's things that we can do, each of us, to try to help ourselves. One is to eat a healthful diet, watch your blood pressure, watch your cholesterol level, exercise, do the kinds of things that are good for overall health. These are also good for, at times, for the ability to forestall the worst impact of Alzheimer's disease, sometimes for as much as years. And that's the kind of years of life that you can't recapture in any other way. So I just encourage people to be healthy, stay healthy, and work at it. It's part of your life that you owe it to yourself to do so.
Fantastic. I appreciate your time, your energy, your work, and thanks for hanging out with me here on the show. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much, Maddie. Thanks so much for having me.
No problem. We'll see you soon. Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learned anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast. Simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.